the importance for net neutrality has been obvious to anybody who's paying attention. And people have been fighting for it for a long time. The difference is now Obama, who, by the way, said there would never be a president who is more a friend to net neutrality than him. Well, he turns around and appoints as the head of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, the former lead lobbyist for the telecom industry. Right? Telecom industry has never liked net neutrality. They don't like the idea that they have to have a level playing field. They see their purpose is to see dollar signs where they can, and particularly in this structural, skeletal kind of level of wanting to give certain people priority access.
This is Adam Chartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Welcome to episode number 221 of FilmWax Radio. That was Brian Knappenberger on the subject of net neutrality, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes and the segment with Brian. Here we are. It's summertime in Brooklyn, 80-ish on average so far. We just came back from a road trip. My son and I, after like five-day road trip, went up to Toronto. Well, by way of the Finger Lakes. If you have not been to the Finger Lakes, this part of New York State, this time of year, you are missing out on something pretty, pretty spectacular. It is picture book beautiful up there. You just drive through these towns and it is spectacular. But we have I have friends in Ithaca, so we stop there. My son loves their dog and my friends too. And it's about halfway, the drive is about halfway to Toronto. It's a good portion of the way up to Buffalo, and then you just kind of go through Buffalo, over the border, and then it's another less than about an hour or so to Toronto, and it's actually quite doable a drive if you break it in two. So we did that, and then spent several days, 3 or 4 days in Toronto with my friends, and I have gotten to know a number of people there, so that was good. And actually took advantage of the trip and interviewed an interesting guy. He is a very known quantity as a filmmaker up in Canada, specifically in Ontario. His name is Alan Zweig, and he will be on a future episode. But I met him, and we recorded a conversation when I was up there. That was a lot of fun. I also recorded a conversation with an internationally renowned filmmaker who has been making films for decades all around the world. I don't know. Should I announce it? Do you want to guess? Hey, that's a good idea. Write in. If you can guess, if you're listening, and you can guess who it is, this is assuming I don't know you that well and haven't told you, so don't cheat. But if you want to take a stab at who this world-renowned filmmaker is, again, they've been around for a long time. Maybe I already mentioned it on the podcast. I'm just stupid. But if you write it in, if you're the first one, I will send you a free DVD. That's, and while you're at it, subscribe to the podcast. If you're taking that much time, you can also go on iTunes and subscribe if you haven't yet. So we did all so that all happened up in Toronto. And we just got back just last night, pretty late. But heading back up, I hope in August, and then again later in September for TIFF. Anyway, I like Toronto quite a bit. Okay, today's show. It is we're winding down at the last days of June. And we are coming up to Doug Block's HBO premiere at the very end of the month, on June 30th, of his latest documentary. It's called 112 Weddings. And Doug is a wedding videographer. Has been a wedding videographer. Continues to be, I think. And over the years, he's 20 years, he has shot so many couples, about 112, I guess. And he goes back to a number of them to interview them and find out how they're doing a bunch of years later. Of course, some of these guys have been married longer than others. And I think there are 9 couples that he interviews from the 112. And it's pretty entertaining. And it has its real powerful moments in it. And it's going to be on HBO. He's bypassing the theatrical. This was an interesting conversation we got into. And I've known Doug now for a few years. Early on, when I used to screen films more frequently, and I hope one day to get back to doing it a lot more, and when there was a FilmWax film series, Doug was one of the first filmmakers to show a film there, and he showed this his classic 51 Birch Street. It's one of the great documentaries, American documentaries. So I've known him for a bit, and this was the first time, though, he's been on the podcast, so I was real excited about that. The other conversation is with Brian Knappenberger, who is a very, very capable documentary filmmaker. Brian made a documentary called We Are Legion a couple of years back about the hacker group called Anonymous, which was really a success. And he's back with a new documentary called The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz, who was a computer programming prodigy. He went on to pioneer all sorts of different technology for the internet, and got into a lot of trouble when he ended up rubbing up against the federal government in his pursuit of freeing up information. He was found dead at the age of 26 in his Brooklyn apartment. Anyway, it's an incredible story. Brian does a wonderful job with The Internet's Boy. It premiered at Sundance just a few months ago. I also had an opportunity to talk to Brian about on the subject of net neutrality, which is of great interest to me as someone who sort of lives on the internet at this point. And also it's a great interest to Brian, and he speaks often about it, and he's very frank. This is my conversation with Brian Knappenberger.
You know, it's easy sometimes to feel like you're powerless, like when you come out in the streets and you march and you yell and nobody hears you. But I'm here to tell you today, you are powerful. You can stop this bill.
A co-founder of the social news and entertainment website Reddit has been found dead.
Aaron learned how to learn at a very young age.
Bob introduced him to computers, and he just took off.
He certainly was a prodigy, although he never kind of thought of himself like that.
He really had different aspirations for the purposes of political goals.
He was sort of learning to hack politics.
Stop SOPA!
This bill poses a serious threat for all who use the internet.
The freedoms our country had been built on would be suddenly deleted. I couldn't let that happen.
Aaron was trying to make the world work. He was trying to fix it.
Bringing public access to the public domain.
Brian Knappenberger, thank you for submitting to the Filmax Radio podcast.
Of course.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's nice to meet you, too. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of your work. I saw We Are Legion. And that was like last summer or two summers
ago? Two summers ago.
Oh, it was already two? Yeah. I think I saw it at South by Southwest.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that was a huge screening. That was lines around the block, which is great.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was the right audience, I think, for that film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so many people that are there to be part of
the interactive
portion, and then they know that you're there with your film, We Are Legion. They're going to obviously you're going to get that crowd as well as the indie film crowd.
So yeah,
that was nice. One thing I want to put out there that if we can talk about before we end is net neutrality.
Sure.
And if you have any thoughts on it, because actually,
I do have thoughts. Yeah.
But where this movie is called The Internet's Own Boy.
Yeah. We premiered at Sundance.
Oh, very good.
And then we opened Hot Docs, and we were also at lucky enough to be at South by Southwest, too.
Yeah. But it was Sundance where you did your world.
Yeah, world premiere was at Sundance.
It's amazing bit of festival success.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But this and We Are Legion, both were in a ton of festivals all around the world. It's been great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a craftsmanship, clearly, to your filmmaking.
Thanks.
But it's also, as you were making a point a second ago, that as maybe also of its time, obviously people now have a little bit of distance from the birth and explosion of the internet in the last 20 years to where we are now, which is kind of we're maybe starting to mentally catch up with the amount of with what's going on and the impact of it all.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, just the fact that we've had, it's almost like a generation of people have kind of now grown up with the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the internet has definitely evolved, and our kind of relationship to it has changed quite a bit, especially in the last decade, but even, of course, going back even farther. And I think Aaron's story points to that, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, it's called The Internet's Own Boy is that he kind of was incubated in this new world in which he was dealing with lots of people much older than him, working in, you know, early kind of computer, free information kind of working groups, RSS working groups, things like that, as a very young, you know, very young kid. And this was the community that kind of forged him.
I rely on RSS feeds for my very show here. Can you explain what his impact creating something like that was and how major that kind of was.
RSS has been critical for the growth of the internet. Of course, like you said, you can use it for podcasts and sort of keeping up to date on the latest sort of feeds. And it's a critical kind of one of those structural tools. And as it was sort of being created and talked about and the standards were being worked out in these kind of early working groups, RSS working groups, there was this guy on there named Aaron Swartz who was holding his own with these, like, you know, people in their 30s and 40s, internet luminaries.
He must have assumed he was
here. Yeah, he was, contributing substantively to this conversation and to the kind of innovation that was happening. And there's a funny story in the film where one guy says, well, when are you going to come out to these face-to-face meetings? I mean, you know, we want to get together and have a face-to-face meeting and kind of discuss all this stuff. And he just says, you know, I'll have to check with my mom. I'm not sure she's going to let me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 14 years old. And, of course, that made everybody want to meet Aaron even more.
Of course. It's kind of the irony to the story is that he, of course, was a firm believer that the internet was all about the democratizing and making it accessible, and that he could be a peer to people twice, three times his age on the internet, and it wouldn't matter in that community.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, that represents the best part of the internet, right? That you can communicate with people across a broad range of age groups and all over the world, and you know, get together like-minded kind of pursuits and collaborate. That's one of the things we like about the internet.
How did you first hear about Aaron?
I was making my previous film, We Are Legion, the story of the hacktivists, and I had been following lots of hackers and hacktivists and people who had, I use that term kind of loosely, hacker. I think it means lots of different things, sometimes very contradictory kinds of behavior. But I was following people that particularly had run afoul of the law, so I was very aware of Aaron's case right from his initial arrest. But it was, it's also struck me that during this kind of new 2-year legal nightmare that he went through, not too many people were following his case, that it wasn't getting a lot of attention, a lot of press attention, certainly in compared to some of the other kind of notorious hacker cases that we've seen the headlines of. So I realized later when I was making the film that the reason for that is that he was actively tamping down any attention to his case. He wasn't talking to his friends about it.
I'm sorry, you were about to say.
Yeah, and that's because he didn't want to bring them into this kind of legal nightmare that he was in. He didn't want to expose them to these prosecutors that were kind of bearing down on him. And anytime he actually did anything or talked about it on the internet, the prosecutors would kind of redouble their efforts and crack down on him even more. So he had a real fear of talking about it, which was a big, which is a big problem. And I think forced him into a kind of isolation.
Absolutely.
That's the worst sort of thing that you can have if you've got any kind of issues and depression or anything.
I was going to mention that because I don't know if we have officially if he was diagnosed ever, but I know that he was certainly grappling with depression.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
At least anecdotally, and that's another, it definitely has an effect on, self-isolation, seclusion.
Yeah.
When you're, fighting depression.
Well, isolation is the worst thing that can happen, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You want to be able to talk to people. But, the issue of depression is
there's
really
there's a lot of shame around it,
Yeah. I mean, people that lived with him, Taryn, his girlfriend, says that maybe perhaps he had something like clinical depression in his early 20s. She doesn't believe, at least she told me, she doesn't believe that he had that when they lived together later in life. Noah, his brother, we were talking the other day, he said that, he never saw anything like clinical depression in him. So, look, I think you have to kind of weigh that as it is. And, clearly he was somebody who carried the weight of the world on his shoulders, Clearly he was upset about problems that he perceived in the world, and he took them really, really seriously, and they weighed on him. But, some of that distracts from this kind of 2-year legal nightmare that he went through that really left him financially and emotionally exhausted. I mean, uncertain of his future for 2 years.
Right. And he was 26.
His research resources. To talk too much about depression sort of takes the eye off the really obvious thing that was bearing down on him.
Right. We have to keep in mind 26, if we remember what it was like to be 26.
Yeah.
The thing with Aaron is he was always so far ahead mentally.
Yeah.
Ahead of his age by, clearly a decade or more. It's almost as if he caught up to his own age finally around this time, around 26. Mm-hmm. And anybody at the age of 26, when you have federal government threatening you with decades of prison,
I mean, that's too much. That's completely intimidating. And, right. You know, of course, that's what the prosecutors want.
Sure.
They want to intimidate. They want to break their this is the point of a prosecutor, to break the defendant, right? To keep leveraging pressure against them. And unfortunately, as a society, we've given prosecutors lots of power to do that. And that's led to all kinds of problems with our system.
And the biggest threat is, it just keeps coming up historically, doesn't it? The unlocking information, exposing information, making information transparent. This is the biggest threat, it seems, everywhere. I mean, we point the finger at these other governments in the Middle East or South America, what have you, as, you know, people being punished for protesting or teaching or what have you.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
And yet, Aaron was part of this, you know, about releasing information.
Open access. Yeah.
And that's a direct relationship to your prior film, too, because that's right what the hacktivists were all about, weren't they?
Yeah, at least partially, for sure.
I mean, as you mentioned before, there's a distinction between different types of hackers. But,
yeah, oh, definitely.
But, I mean, the one thing they do have in common is unlocking information.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, we live in a world, a political climate, where there are science deniers, right? The people that want to pretend like, you know, climate change isn't happening, despite the fact that nearly, people say 95% of scientists, it's actually more like 100% of scientists agree that we are going through a pretty dramatic climate change. And yet we have people like Boehner, you know, shrugging their shoulders, throwing their hands up in the air, going, well, I don't know about climate change because I'm not a scientist. Well, of course you're not a scientist, you know, but did you, you know, build your own car? You know, you're not an engineer either. Mm-hmm. You presumably still drive a car. You know, like, it's really a silly, absurd position. Mm-hmm. And yet, information is power. Information is, you know, knowledge is part of the battlefield, certainly in this modern time. So, you know, knowing what's happening in the world, how do you solve the problems of the world without knowing what's going on? How do you solve what's, how do you make life better for people? How do you solve these big kind of intractable problems like climate change? How do you learn how to govern yourself or ourselves, which is really what we should be doing in a democracy, without knowing how the world works, without the kind of science and technology, the sorts of things that Aaron was after, or without, you know, even in the case of Edward Snowden, this notion of what our actual relationship is with our government, what they think their relationship is with us in terms of being able to push the boundaries of the Fourth Amendment and interpret the Patriot Act and search and conduct these kind of mass suspicionless dragnet surveillance of citizens. How do we know how to best be citizens in a democracy without knowledge? So knowledge becomes the battleground. It becomes the most important battleground.
Well, the government's used to making soldiers, too, and they're taught not to think for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, look, governments, they're, you know, Zoe Lofgren says in the film that their purpose is to control. I mean, governments seek to control. And the purpose of legislature, the purpose of judicial branch, you know, this is to keep that in check.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are experiencing a time in which there's everything's sort of out of balance. The checks and balances are kind of not in balance, where the executive power has way more power.
Mm-hmm.
and our legislative branch is almost useless. The executive branch can execute wars and turn around planes with people on it at the drop of a hat, with extraordinary precision. And while you know, the legislative branch, the branch that we are the closest to, that's our part of it, right?
Yeah.
That's the one that we have those are our representatives, are basically bought and sold and almost completely useless. I mean, truly, almost completely mm-hmm. useless. I mean, this Congress is, you know, I think it's a shame we called any other Congress ever the do-nothing Congress, because now we're sort of out of descriptions for this one. This one is about as bad as it gets.
Yeah.
And why is that? Our branch, the citizens' branch of the government, is so dysfunctional.
We certainly are turning over a lot of our thinking to technology. Is it possibly that more and more as technology gets...
No, I don't think that's true. I mean,
okay.
I think... Look, I mean, the message, you know, it becomes a different... In the modern age, the democratic participatory democratic process is different. You know, we organize differently. You know, we communicate differently online. We protest differently now. And I think that if we cherish those things, you know, the ability to protest, the ability to kind of address our grievances with our representatives, the ability, things like freedom of, if we care about things like freedom of speech and expression and the right not to be searched by your government without due process, if we care about all those things, presumably as a country, as a democracy, then those things need to make their way into this internet world too. You know, the internet world is not new. The networked lives that we live are not somehow some new thing. This is the way everybody lives. So all of that stuff has to make it its way into this world.
What year was it, Aaron? He was 26 when he committed suicide. Yeah. And that was how many years back?
He committed suicide January 2013.
What is it like to make a documentary without meeting your subject? And do you is it more of a process of getting to know someone that you haven't met, or through discussions and interviews that you've had with people who knew him well? Do you feel a sense of getting to know him better? Is that something that even matters ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. We were in the very similar kind of communities for a while, and I knew a lot of people that he knew. There was a lot of crossover. And so, and I particularly knew his ex-girlfriend, Quinn Norton. So, you know, it's interesting because you are listening to people talk about him. You're crafting a story based on their recollections and their personal interactions with this person that they loved. Mm-hmm. But you're also looking at, you're digging up, you know, we live in an age where, you know, lots of things are being recorded a lot. So you're getting, you know, there. And he was somebody that was a kind of go-to expert on some tech issues. and he was really good at that. I mean, he was something he was great at, explaining technical issues for people when people could understand their relevance really to their lives. So, you know, so we dug up in, you know, archival footage that of him talking, you know, directly to camera, him answering questions about technology. And so you see him change, you see his thought process change, you see him physically change. He grows up in the course of the film. So it's really crafting as full a portrait as you can of this kind of remarkable life.
Mm-hmm. And you feel like you've got, you figured something out about him, or maybe you have some sort of deeper connection to him.
As a result. I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, it is an odd exercise to be making a film about somebody that you haven't met.
Yeah.
So it's just about listening and hoping that people close to him, you know, participate in the film, which they did. And
they certainly did.
Incredibly, incredibly lucky for his family to open up to us. I think it took a lot of courage. I think it's courageous for everybody participate in this film, but
yeah, it still seems like in many cases the loss is still very much immediate for them too,
yeah, which, it is. And you know, we made this film pretty quick, by documentary standards. We were at Sundance within a week of the 1 year anniversary of his death.
Wow, that is fast.
And so that means we were talking to people really soon after they'd lost somebody that they loved.
Yeah.
So it was something I was very conscious of the whole time.
I'm sure you had to be, yeah. And what did his family, what did they think of the finished film?
They've been really, really supportive.
They're happy with the way it came out?
Yeah, and they're very happy with the film, yes. Yeah, okay. They've been super supportive and just have been really, really lucky.
The film is called The Internet's Own Boy, directed by Brian Knappenberger, and it opens in theaters and on VOD, but see it in the theater if you can on June 27th. I'm kind of interested. I feel like I have an invested stake myself in, obviously, this is my home, the internet. I've made my, it's where I summer.
Yeah, exactly.
At this point, and this is, I think a lot of people, including myself, keep, you know, reading and hearing about net neutrality as a real hot issue right now, and how much is in jeopardy. Can you just kind of tell me what's in the balance, I guess, and what's really, what your take is?
Here. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, the notion of net neutrality has been really important, to people for decades. I mean, really the openness and the kind of level playing field aspect of the internet has been there since the beginning. I mean, Tim Berners-Lee gave away the internet for free, the World Wide Web. It's the only reason we have it. Yeah, it's the only reason we have the world internet. So that openness is at the heart of the internet. And it's been the cause of so much innovation, so much expression, so much of the... I mean, look, there's a lot of bad things about the internet. But the part that's really
good... That's
another
documentary.
No, it's part it's of many this one, too.
Yeah, yes, very true.
But you know, what we love about the internet, the freedom of the expression and the creative potential and the ability to do podcasts and meet interesting people and connect and to organize political campaigns and to have, you know, to... have a political message. Everything that all comes out of a level playing field, right? So the importance for net neutrality has been obvious to anybody who's paying attention forever. And people have been fighting for it for a long time. The difference is now Obama, who, by the way, said there would never be a president who is more a friend to net neutrality than him. There'd never be somebody in that office who's a bigger friend to net neutrality than Obama, right? Well, he turns around and appoints as the head of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, the former lead lobbyist for the telecom industry, right? Telecom industry has never liked net neutrality. They don't like the idea that they have to have a level playing field. They see their purpose is to see dollar signs where they can, and the people have seen dollar signs in the internet since the very, very beginning, particularly in this structural, skeletal kind of level of wanting to prioritize, give certain people priority access. And
charge for it, I assume, and
kick,
right?
Yeah, and charge for it and kick everybody else to the curb. But anybody paying attention to this for a long time knows that two-tiered system will break everything we love about the internet. That notion that there's one internet, a fast internet for the fast lane for the 1%, dirt road for everybody else, is gonna kill innovation. That's not promoting innovation. That takes the new startup and puts them at a disadvantage to the established company. That's not what the internet's about. That takes the established companies and the people with the most money and gives them the political message that gets to you before the alternative message. It throttles creativity. It throttles expression. It throttles independent voices and filmmakers. And I mean, it's just an awful idea. And yet it's something that those companies see as a way to make more money, and so it's been in their crosshairs. They want to kill it, and now that they've got their main ex guy at the head of the FCC, they're rubbing their sweaty palms together and aiming putting net neutrality in their crosshairs. And we've got a really short period of time in order for people to kind of stand up and say, we don't want this. We want all of that good stuff on the internet. We want to keep that. We want the innovation. We want the clear political messages, and we want the innovation, the business innovation.
Yeah, we'll put up, I'm sure there are much more information available about it, and also how people can contact their legislators, the lazy legislators, ineffective legislators.
Yeah.
But they, at a certain point, the pressure must be effective if enough people.
Well, the FCC has asked for comments, and we're in this brief public comment period.
Oh, I see.
So let's get comments. Some comments. Yeah.
Like comments is like we find at the bottom of blogs.
Yeah, a
or
like that.
Comments on. So hopefully a little bit more.
Hopefully we're in an open comment
bearing.
Period.
Yeah.
You know, they're giving it to us. Hopefully we can push it. But also it doesn't hurt to come.
Well, rise up, everybody. Well, I was thinking about it a lot in the last weeks and months because, I do this thing and myself, and I'm thinking I just take it for granted. Not that there's something wrong with it on a certain level. I mean, we have certain what we consider inalienable rights that we on some level might want to take for granted, but on a daily basis. But when it comes down to it, and there is something that might be threatening, it's our responsibility to say no, that's not acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, this is how we communicate now. This is how we organize politics. This is how, by the way, Obama got into office.
Truth.
By organizing grassroots through a neutral, fair playing field. This is why he is the president. I mean, it couldn't be a more stark example than that. And yet now he's turning against the very thing that got him in there. And you know, yeah, it makes a difference to everybody. This is the public domain now. This is how we talk. This is how we communicate. This is how, I mean, you know, you can do a podcast And you're not competing for speed. Your speed gets there to your audiences just the same way as these big companies. Why should they throttle you because you don't have the money to pay? That's throttling speech. That's throttling your ability to create a show and to express. And by the way, you could come up with the next biggest, greatest show ever. And
I'd so like to we, think so.
Well, you might. Yeah. No,
keep coming on my show. Yeah. Maybe we get
no,
there.
No, but it's true. I mean, why are we privileging even more these big corporations that already have so much leverage?
And have individual rights.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
so we're already in the difficult spot.
Yeah.
And we have to try to unravel the...
And how do we unravel it without a free and open internet in order to talk about it? Right.
They're first things first.
How do we unravel it? Yeah. How do we organize in order to overturn Citizens United or other things without free expression? And how do we express ourselves now? We express it through the internet.
So Aaron Swartz is really a First Amendment crusader in a way,
absolutely.
You know, in a very basic way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
As much as...
I do think that he, you know, he says things in the film like, you know, if the internet had been around... in the early days of the sort of republic, there would have been ISPs in the Constitution, not post office mail, you know, post offices. And I think that's pretty obvious. That's true.
Thank you, Brian, very much.
Yeah, of course.
Appreciate it. Again, The Internet's Own Boy will be available through the internet.
It will be.
For the moment, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
On June 27th. Check the internet also for theater listings.
Yeah.
And find out where Internet's Home Boy is screening near you on Friday, June 27th. Thanks again. Again, Doug Block is a very talented filmmaker. He made... 51 Birch Street, which is a very powerful documentary about his parents and growing up in Long Island. He made The Kids Grow Up a couple of years ago about his daughter graduating high school and going off to college and what that separation was like for him. And most recently, now he has a new film called 112 Weddings. Doug has the very, very... unusual distinction of having all of his featured documentaries broadcast on HBO. I don't mean that like it just ends up playing on HBO. I mean, they distribute it. It's an HBO documentary. 112 Weddings is the latest, and it will, again, will have its broadcast premiere on June 30th. Here's my conversation with Doug Block.
Now you can kiss.
For the past 20 years, I've helped support my work as a documentary filmmaker by shooting the weddings of total strangers.
As long as you both shall live,
I do.
It's like being granted a front row view as an ordinary couple experiences the most extraordinary day of their lives.
To be sensitive at all times to each other's needs.
But I can't help but wonder, do they have any idea what they're getting into?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
Where do you think marriage was going to be? Did you know from the beginning this is the woman you want to spend the rest of your life with? Can you pinpoint a time when you became unhappy in the marriage?
Life can be fun, yeah. Life can be very funny.
I'm going to devote the rest of my life to you. That's kind of insane.
Yeah, but not too much background, not too much Sam Cooke here.
No, it's fine. Well, once the mic is on, I can hear my voice. I just feel so placated and so at ease.
Oh,
you know,
here it comes.
There's something about my voice, which is we're at the Almar restaurant, the beautiful. The Almar, look at this, we're being Almar restaurant in Dumbo, right on Front Street. What's the address? 111 Front Street. I highly recommend it if you're in the Dumbo area and you want to get a bite to eat. Come to Almar, right on Front Street. He's finished school, and I've been dragging him around to all these different people. But he met, like, Olympia Dukakis the other day. He meets people. You know, he doesn't realize, you know, he's not interested, but not remotely. But finally, it's great to do this podcast with the one and only Doug Block. We've talked many times,
mm-hmm.
and we've done a bunch of these.
Yes, we
never
have.
Never for this thing. So did you know I was doing this for a long time?
I was aware, yeah, okay. that you've had a great deal of longevity.
Well, I mean,
you're an institution.
Well, it's a couple of years now I've been doing this, but when I was doing my little intimate film series, you were like one of the first like films I showed. At
51 Burt Street?
Yeah, 51 Burt Street, wow. in Park Slope.
Right.
And it was so early in my programming career, my own series, that I programmed that on like Mother's Day, which was nice on a certain level because so much of that movie is about your mother.
Right.
On the other hand, everybody who could have come to see the screening was with their mother.
With their mothers, yes.
You know, appropriately
the
so.
The ones who saw it hate their mothers, you know, so.
I don't even think my mother came, and she lived nearby. Anyway, that was a while ago. But that was already after The Kids Grow Up came out. And I think that was about to have a theatrical at the Angelica, maybe, here in New York?
That's right. We are bypassing theatrical on this sucker.
Well, this is, and what is this sucker?
The sucker is 112 Weddings.
Which has been, on some level, in the making for 10, 20 years, right?
Yeah. I like The Kids Grow Up, which I had in mind for many, many years to make a film about my daughter as she was growing up. She just, you know, I just had so much fun footage with her every year of the years. And I don't just mean playful, you know, home movies. I mean interviews.
Cinema.
And seriously interesting stuff, but I, you know, for the longest time couldn't figure out a way to put a narrative to it until her last year at home, when it dawned on me she would be leaving soon and that there was a, you know, kind of an ending, a very bittersweet ending of sending her off into the world and, you know, the looming empty nest, and that all that footage I'd done over the years could be used as memory. Anyway, but, an idea for many, many years was on the back burner, and what I always called the wedding film was in my mind almost from the first wedding I shot 20 years ago.
Is that true? But it's interesting how you describe the, you know, The Kids Grow Up, because it was an ending, but it was an ending more for you. It was a beginning for her because she was just starting her adulthood, you know what I mean, and just starting this new chapter in her life. But
sure.
But I understand. It's ultimately a film also about yourself.
Well, you impose a narrative on these things, you know, as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's a false narrative, but, you know, sometimes it's an exaggerated narrative. Like, in the film, my role is to be sort of the brokenhearted dad, you know, the one who's trying to, you know, hold on to his daughter, not literally, but, you know, figuratively, and has having a hard time letting go. Yes, that was absolutely true on one level, and on another level, I was also totally thrilled for my daughter and her, you know, to be spreading her wings and flying off. I mean, that's your role as a parent. But that was sort of too complex an idea for the narrative of the film. So, you know, the only problem is my daughter in real life confused my role in the narrative with how I actually felt, and we had to have a talk afterwards to kind of unravel what my true feelings were, separate them out for what
I conveniently
imposed for my character in the film.
Interesting. So tell me, 112 Weddings, which I know is takes, you're a wedding videographer for many years. That's how you made a living since you're a documentary filmmaker.
Well, it's how part, I
it contributed.
Helped tide, yeah, it was tied
it's how
me
you
over
pay,
money.
Help pay the rent,
yeah,
as it were. And you decided that to go revisit several of the those couples.
Yep.
And find out how they're doing.
Pretty simple premise.
It's a beautiful premise, and people love that type of where are they now.
Oh my God.
Is a huge.
Everybody I tell what I'm doing, they like from word go. It's been, are you kidding?
Yeah.
I want to see that.
Exactly.
I mean, I just think it's human curiosity,
right.
to look at another couple and you know, they if they look really happy, to go, you know, be very suspicious, you know, or to wonder what it's really like behind closed doors, or
right, yeah.
or even, well, what do they know that we don't know? You know, what's
yeah.
their secret?
Right. Well, any documentary subject is always going to be withholding something, right? So, yeah. But what's the question, I guess, is to start is, what was the narrative that you imposed on this story as you described the one that, you know, in The Kids Grow Up? What's the one here? What's the personal
narrative? That's a really interesting question, because at first I thought I would have to impose a narrative on it. You know, I kept thinking, you know, wow, what's the glue? I go back to, you know, what turned out to be 9 couples. And at first I didn't think it would be that many, but I just found them so interesting once I started talking to them. And I thought, well, wow, don't I have to learn something from this journey I'm taking back to these couples? You know, what's the glue that holds them all together? And I, you know, going into the shooting, I thought, yeah, maybe my own marriage needs to be part of it. It's not like my last films were an autobiographical, and I think everybody would have accepted my imposing that on the film. But a funny thing happened. And by the way, I started it on our 25th anniversary year, which coincided with the first year of The Empty Nest. And so it was actually kind of a difficult year. There's a reason why many marriages fall apart when the kids leave home. So I thought, oh, you know, maybe that's an interesting starting place to start going back to the couples. And, you know, whatever I learned from them, I kind of, you know, used to help work out my own marriage. The problem is, that's not what happened. We worked it out. You know, like everything in our marriage, like most marriages, if they last for a while, you know, you have rocky times and then you recover. You talk it through, you work it out, you know, or time goes by and time works its little magic. But by the time I really got into the filmmaking, we worked it through, and it seemed wrong to kind of impose this false narrative on it for the sake of convenience for this movie I'm making. And also, frankly, as I got going, I felt like I didn't need it, that the couples themselves were interesting enough, and enough questions came up about the whole institution of marriage and why we get married and what our expectations are and how that changes through the experience. And then also actually bringing in a new couple about to get married imposed a kind of narrative structure to it. It's getting closer and closer to their wedding, and it's not giving anything away that it ends on their wedding day.
It keeps the film sort of anchored in the here and now, you know, as you're, you know, because this is in real time, seems like that this wedding is coming together.
But it was a real editing challenge, this film.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, structuring it. I mean, I work with an amazing editor, Maeve O'Boyle, who I worked with in The Kids Grow Up. And let's just say we did a lot of shuffling of index cards.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. When, as I watched the film and I turned on the film and I started watching, I was immediately struck by the fact that I knew the first couple personally. So I dashed off a note to you because I'm like, this is weird. I know Paul Shapiro and his wife,
Rachel,
from my, not that I attend anymore, but we all went to the same synagogue. And I also went to see Paul perform a number of times. Mm-hmm. He's a musician, very talented musician. And what a wonderful guy he is, too. He's just a certain...
He's a sweetheart.
Yeah, he's a real... he's
a mensch.
A mensch is exactly... Mensch. If you look at a mensch in the Yiddish dictionary, there is Paul.
I mean, sweetheart.
Yeah. Well,
he's a good musician.
And there's a photo
musician.
Right by that meaning, right? That definition right there of Paul. Anyway, in his little soul patch or what have you. Doesn't he have the... He has the little hair on, right? Yeah. Yeah, so it was very strange. But then I remembered my synagogue was a couple blocks from where you live, and it makes sense that you might know him from
neighbor. You know, I thought it would be good to start the film with somebody you knew. Go from there.
Exactly. Thank you. So how did you choose these couples? I mean, if there were over 100 couples...
You know, they're just...
What goes into
in
that?
Your memory, I draw out a list. You know, without looking at my list of weddings, you know, I have a database and stuff, but without even looking at it, I just thought, okay, off the top of my head, which couples come to mind first? And I started writing names down. This is when I'm thinking of who I'm going to interview. And, there's just certain couples that stand out because, you know, I felt like I got to know them better somehow, either in the back and forth of being hired and shooting with them, or... You know, they had followed my career as a documentary filmmaker, had come to my films and were written nice notes, or, you know, when you start, you also want people who will agree to be interviewed.
Right.
So
we're more likely to be open and right and vulnerable and all these things because they knew you and they trusted you.
For me to, you know, to agree to be interviewed about how their marriage is going. So Paul and Rachel are one. I've been in touch. I knew Rachel better than most because she was actually an intern for me for a while, back when.
Oh, okay.
And the next two couples, it's very funny with Olivia, the third couple, the one with the child who got sick. She was a masseur, and she couldn't afford my rate, so we bartered. She could pay half of it and paid off the other half in massages. So I got a lot of, you know, we got to know each other when she was giving me massages over leading up to her wedding. So, you know, I went immediately, my first three couples, I just went for who I thought would talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to think, okay, who, by way of contrast and diversity, can I think of that sort of balances out? And, you know, you're limited by who hired you for this kind of film. I mean, I'm literally going through my list of clients, and I can't go outside that. So, and I knew I wanted some divorces just because you have to. How can you go back and not include it?
Yeah,
so
that would be
a failure. Very tricky to navigate because obviously some divorced couples did not want to speak on camera.
No, in fact, the one couple you spoke to, they were like a Long Island couple or something, who is the woman, she had kind of curly hair.
Mm-hmm.
Stocky husband had lost all the weight,
and
she was just very, very open, and it's kind of, you know, I mean, contextually, when you're used to watching reality television, and in no way, you know, I'm not comparing what you do to reality television, but you're so used to people being so blatantly open, quote unquote, in front of the camera, but so it was almost surprising that I should still be kind of impressed by how just when it, not just her but others in your film too are so candid. Yeah. It still comes as something of a shock. And of course, the guy who's had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I think the difference is reality TV. They pump up the emotion. They're after the anger, and the
humiliation.
The humiliation and that kind of pumped up emotion.
Right.
And I think what's really, you know, startling to see, even still, in this day of reality TV, is when somebody is so raw, like Sue was in that interview, and so real, you know, and it's just, you know, she's not pumping this up for the camera. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm trying as best I can to have them forget a camera's there, and it's just the two of us talking. So I think the real, the thing that this film has going for it is my relationship with the couples that, you know, yes, I was hired to shoot their wedding day, but I'm with them alone on this, you know, extraordinary day in their lives. And we're there feeling the whole range of emotions so intensely. And then I give them their tapes and I never see them again. So even if I call on them, in Sue's case, it was almost 20 years later, you know, it's like I'm a long-lost friend. And they know immediately who I am. And when I see them, we're right back to where we were. And I'm not coming with a crew to do the interview. It's just me. Very minimal lighting, if any.
In their homes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I try to make them as comfortable as possible and sit the couples that are together to, you know, next to each other. In a mostly two shot, so you see the body language and the reactions, and that's as revealing, if not more so, than what they're saying. So, you know, in the context of reality TV, if I were to be like a reality TV producer coming in, it would be so gruesome. People would hate me, you know, and flee the theater, I think. It's because, in a sense, I'm standing in for the audience. You know, we're all curious and we're all voyeuristic. But on the other hand, you know, we don't want to be rude. We don't want to come into barging into these people's homes and asking really indelicate questions or exploitive questions or, you know, badgering them about their sex lives, you know, and, you know, how often do you do it? I mean, it's you can't. So it's kind of a fun dance trying to get at what people's marriage is like without kind of directly putting them on the spot.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of the comedy of the film is. It gets huge laughs when it plays with an audience.
Oh, I bet. Because we all can relate.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all either been married or our parents have been.
Right. But we're Jacob. Also but Jacob. We're also really nosy. We're really curious about mm-hmm. other people. But like if you and go to a dinner party, you're not going to sit there and ask I mean, unless you're totally drunk out of your mind, you're not going to ask rude questions. You're kind of going to feel out what their marriage is like, you know, and it's kind of, you know, a little comic dance that you do.
You also want to sit next to somebody who's more, you know, maybe a little charismatic or has something to talk about.
Right.
And I was wondering, when you were kind of going through your database, the one in your head, about which couples you wanted to invite into the film, and I'm wondering if you thought about the, like, who would be maybe the most, you know, come off maybe the most cinematic in that way,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I mean, it had less to do with their weddings than their personalities. Yeah, there were a few I knew were kind of live wires or just kind of really
fun. Certainly that the couple that, you know, the one that was did ultimately have run into mental health issues. I'm sure even then you saw that these both of them were a bit over the top. And
I actually wondered if he was a little too over the top. And whether that would be, you know.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah,
throw an imbalance to the film.
Throw an imbalance, but no, he, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, when you're telling people stories, we're very aware, Maeve and I were very aware that we had like, you know, between 5 and maybe 8 minutes to tell these individual stories and then, of course, find a way to interweave them so that they come back and they're not just, it's not just one after the other after the other. And, you know, you want to impose as best you can within that time frame a bit of an arc mm-hmm. to the story.
Sure.
And he was really interesting because, you know, he says these wild, outrageous things. You know, like at one point he begins by saying, you know, Janet was just a horrible wife. And, like, the audience gasps when they hear this.
Right. And what a betrayal in front of the camera.
Yeah, in front of the camera.
We don't like him then.
Oh, no.
Because he puts himself in that peril. That he knows that if he does that, nobody's going to like him.
Yeah.
Right?
And then, but within like the 6-7 minutes that he's on, I think he becomes enormously sympathetic by
Absolutely.
The end. And
sure.
that was part of the pleasure, you know, of you know, creating these scenes.
And a complexity of human nature. Like, how do you end up in that where that's something that occurs to you to say? And then, like, but you see the complexity of this person. And we can relate to it.
But it's part of the fun of being a documentary filmmaker. I mean, with 51 Bird Street, it was the same challenge portraying both my mother and my father. You know, that you know, you're almost intentionally playing with the audience sympathy. You know, that you want them, you know, you want my father to kind of, in simplistic terms, to be the bad guy. At the beginning, to be the one who betrayed my mother, possibly, mm-hmm. and what's going on here, and he's very, seemingly very evasive, and by the end of the film, you know, he's this teddy bear you just want to hug, and that's the fun of it, is, you know, in fiction, we're always talking about the character arc and the narrative arc, and how relationships shift over the course of the film, and, you know, we did our best to kind of tell these rounded stories within a very limited time frame, so that each of the stories in and of itself is interesting.
112 Weddings is going to premiere on HBO on Monday,
June 30th.
June 30th, so it's just around the corner. When you're talking to HBO,
mm-hmm.
as you've been used to doing for some time now, this is your...
Yeah, this is the fourth one I've done with them.
Fourth one.
Yeah.
So this
not,
is...
not
was 51 Bird Street at HBO?
Yeah, I mean, they're all, the last four have been with them, and they come on early as a pre-sale. So it's not like I'm commissioned by HBO or HBO pays for the whole thing.
Got it.
They give me what I call getting in trouble money.
But you're able to, you go to, well, but it makes it easier to get financing.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's I shoot without getting funding at all because I shoot as a one-person crew, so I don't need it. What's good is I usually make a sample once I've got enough footage done, shot.
Yeah, you can show.
Put together a sample where they can sort of see what the story is and who the characters are. And what's great is it's formed enough so that they know exactly what they're getting.
Right.
And
and if you can keep the... And so far, of all three, I would say your themes are all been fairly simple in the, you know, general broad stroke. And of course, when you start digging deeper, like any story, it's complex, but especially personal ones. But in describing it, I would imagine. And then if as an investor, if I know, like, you're going to be on HBO, I'm pretty confident that I'll get my investment.
that?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's really hard to get an investor for a personal story, you know, because it's not, even if it's universal themes of family and you know, parent-child relationships, it's hard to sell your own story in a film because it doesn't seem to be, you know, it doesn't seem to be universal. You can't really tell that until you see the film. And then you go, oh my God, that story is so universal. But in describing 112 weddings, I mean, that is kind of no-brainer universal because it's not about my marriage. It's about
other,
you know,
marriages.
Other marriages. It's about, you know,
their marriages.
You know, I'm the observer going back, right. And I'm not, you know, not looking inward. And there's something far more, you know, comforting about that. It doesn't depend on, it doesn't depend at all on your, you know, who I am or what my family is like. In those films, you actually have to see it to understand, you know,
it's archival,
be recognized as a good film. But
I'm sorry, it's archival too. But it's your archive, so it's kind of in that way. It's also not.
You know, I mean,
I like
doing both. I mean, I like doing autobiographical films. I like doing films that have nothing to do with me. I did a short last year that I was hired for on childhood domestic violence, and it was a fantastic story. I loved being paid to do a documentary. That was refreshing and an experience I would love to repeat. But
if you're listening, you know, and you want a documentary made.
Yeah. I still do weddings. Hell, you know. My rate's gone up. But it's, you know, I mean, I just like the documentary process, but it's... I've always liked as a theme and as somebody to play with in documentary, the subject of time. Because that's, you know, I think that's always something that's going on in my films underneath, is the impact of time. You know, and because I am playing with archival footage that goes back many, many years, in, you know, of my own family. And with my daughter, obviously, with her growing up over a lifetime. And in here, in the, you know, the contrast between the wedding day and the juxtaposition of the wedding day with the present day interviews, which are either 5, 10, 15 years later, you know, in many of the cases. So, I mean, just seeing how people look different, you know, what time does to their looks and their, you know, their personas, I guess, is really interesting. You know, I always, you know, it's a big difference between documentary and fiction. Other than, you know, Richard Linklater's film Boyhood that's coming out. I mean, it's the only fiction film I can think of that has a documentary-like approach where you use the same actor and actors over time. You know, I always maintained if they made a fictionalized version of The Kids Grow Up, they'd have three or four different actresses playing Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And at best, they'd get comments like, wow, they did a great job of casting. They all look so much alike. But you know those are four different actors. Whereas with Lucy, every time you cut to her, it was sort of startling because it wasn't chronological. We just cut around in time.
Mm-hmm.
And to see what she looked like and what sounded like and her affect was at different ages was in and of itself pretty fascinating.
I think Truffaut, his was it trilogy or... like the four films, three or four films he made with the
Antoine,
same character.
Antoine Dwanell. Character, yeah.
I think he
started
kind of...
400 Blows.
400 Blows.
Yeah.
And then, I forget what it's not Bed and Breakfast, obviously, but it's like... Anyway, there's those four. I think there were four of them.
You could Google it.
But it's more fun to show off. But you have to successfully...
It's more fun to sort of stumble for the... What the hell? Oh, my God, my brain is going.
You have to recall all the films, though. That's the...
I know what you mean. Bed and Board was the last one.
Thank you.
What's the Stolen Kisses?
Stolen Kisses. So for that whole...
My mind's coming back.
I'm going to have to go back in and re-record myself saying it, though, and remove you now. last question, kind of going back to the beginning of the conversation. You mentioned that you're bypassing... a theatrical, and I was wondering how much that pleases HBO, or they don't care at all.
Oh, they love it. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I would imagine.
They always want you to bypass theatrical.
They don't enforce that. Of course, they can't. But I'm wondering.
Oh, they can. Okay. They can.
They
go through periods where they're a little bit more assertive about their right to do that. I've fought them in the past to do it, and won. I can't say they love it. They, understandably, want a film to go out as, you know, branded as an HBO documentary. But it's not even it's not a matter of HBO so much mm-hmm. as yeah. where the theatrical marketplace is for documentaries now, mm-hmm. and whether you know, it's just worth it as a filmmaker to spend the money and the time and the energy. I mean, it's one thing, the money itself that you're spending on, you know, ads or, you know, to hire, in our case, like a, you know, and have a service deal. There are some particulars of having HBO on board with a television sale that makes it difficult to get a normal distributor mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for various reasons. You know, that U.S. sale is gone. You know, they may be a corporate competitor of Time Warner, which is the parent company of HBO. So there's all this expense of doing it, but you're also it takes so much time and effort, and that means you're not getting paid for work you're doing. You're not just not making, you know, spending money. You're not making money, and you know, then you're not just competing against other documentaries. You're opening up, and you know, on a weekend when 20, 25 other films are opening, it's a battle to even get a review that's more than a paragraph or two.
And you want it their top reviewer, not necessarily.
I mean, look, I've been very lucky. A.O. Scott has been extraordinarily kind to me in my films. Mm-hmm. You know, made 51 Bird Street one of his top 10 films of the year. I don't know, you know, he gave a great review that The Kids Grow Up and it didn't impact the box office. You know, it's just really hard on such limited funds to make a dent that way. And also, you know, when you open theatrically, it strings your window out, you know, because of, you know, with HBO on board, you can't do day and date. So you wind up being on TV months and months after you open theatrically, and then DVD is way after that, and nobody remembers it anymore by then.
No. Yeah.
What's going on now is we're having this really wonderful festival, very visible festival run that's, you know, creating a lot of excitement and attention and buzz for the film, and then people can see it. It's like, oh, we don't have to wait. It's like June 30th. You know, mm-hmm. it's like we have 3 months of festivals, and then we're out. And it's really, you know, just such a great feeling to know that we're not going to have, you know, like you go to festivals, documentary festivals, and, you know, people come. I mean, we've packed every screening. You open in a theater in New York, mm-hmm. and suddenly there's like 20 people there, and it's so discouraging. It's so hard to get people to spend, you know, $13, $14 to go see a documentary in a theater when it opens, because they know it's going to be on TV or DVD. They know they can pirate it eventually or whatever. It's just there's so many other things competing for their money. Festivals are a very different thing, and that really is your, you know, and for most documentaries, that is your theatrical, or it should be your theatrical. But, you know, filmmakers, look, understandably, particularly if they're new filmmakers, you know, they want that review. They want that glory or that perceived glory. And I know so many filmmakers who do choose to do that, and they open and nothing happens, you know. They're not
or they
get a middling review or something, and then they're, you know, nobody comes and sees the film. And
yeah.
It's hard. It's just very hard.
Good answer. Because I'm looking for those, you know, especially I'm constantly mentioning this in the show, you know, over time, is I think theatrical is doesn't really make sense anymore. A 7-day, typical conventional theatrical. There's the for some filmmakers, maybe they think that also brings them consideration for an Oscar, I suppose, because that meets that requirement. But
yeah, but I mean, you have to weigh what your real chances are of getting an Oscar.
Right.
You know, there's no model. You know, I'm doing this in part because of my circumstances, because I have HBO on board, because I've made a number of films, and I don't feel like I have to open it theatrically, you know, to make or break my reputation. But it makes sense now, I think, to do it this way, you know, for this particular film. And, you know, things are shifting very rapidly in the marketplace. But, you know, the old model of opening your film theatrically and being, you know, discovered because, you know, or having some big distributor find you at a Sundance and, you know, give you this huge, you know, guarantee and all these ads and stuff. I mean, this, you know, it happens to two or three documentaries a year now. And often they're a particular kind of bigger documentary, you know, shot in a kind of, you know, quote unquote bigger way, mm-hmm. you know, with bigger production values. You know, the 20 Feet from Stardom had some pretty big production values.
Right.
Man on Wire
sort of builds this sort of, you know, gravity around it. Or
exactly.
This
Searching
kind of
for
momentum.
Sugar Man, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it was made by one guy on his own money for
Without
a long time,
any
but
background.
He
yeah.
shot it beautifully. I mean, yeah. And, you know, it had these kinds of production values that made it feel like a bigger cinematic story.
Yeah.
You
so
know,
with,
when you have a raw documentary, it's just harder to if you get that kind of backing, you know, from a distributor.
Would you do a music doc?
I'd love to do a music doc. Sure. Yeah. With cranes.
know, Crane shots.
Many cameras, you know. And
yeah, dolly shots. And
yeah, I'd love to do, like, how about a remake of The Last Waltz?
How about a fiction version of that?
A fiction version, yeah.
Of the, but, you know, the making of The Last Waltz.
But don't you, I mean, was that amazing? He hired every great director of photography in Hollywood. You know, I had, you know, if you looked at the list of all the camera guys on The Last Waltz, Scorsese had, like,
yeah.
most of, I know, incredible list of DPs ever. So,
Haskell
can't
Wexler.
Top that. Haskell Wexler, Vilmos Zsigmond, I mean,
know,
like,
yeah,
you know, you name it, on and on and on and on
yeah,
and on.
Yeah.
I'm surprised everybody
for a month
but
or two.
Vittorio Storaro, I think,
right,
was
yeah.
on that.
For those 3 or 4 months or what have you. Well, it was much longer, I suppose. That's the problem with why you need so many. But they were like, nobody was available. Well, again, 112 Weddings is going to have its broadcast premiere on HBO Monday, June 30th. And
then they're going to repeat it a lot.
It'll
be on HBO
well,
Go.
Well,
but,
once
they,
it's on HBO
they said,
Go, you can
it'll
see
be
it
on
when you want
a
to.
Lot, repeated a lot in July. So.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's also playing theatrically overseas. So it's Dogwoof is distributing it overseas. So it's actually playing in theaters. I am getting some theatrical. It's
yeah.
just in Canada and the UK.
Got it.
And now I think Italy and you know, we keep picking up countries. So, you know.
It's a big. I mean, it's premiering just on the kind of in the period of time when a lot of people, at least in the States, get married. Is that a good thing to watch as you're venturing into?
I think so. I think it's like a really interesting date film or date
okay.
TV experience,
right. yeah.
whatever you call that. It certainly is an opening for conversation. You know, I've heard from couples about to get married who said that absolutely didn't. You know, convince them not to get married. You know, it's a serious look at marriage. You know, it's a grown-up look at marriage.
Right.
So, you know, I think the more people understand that it's not just this, you know, happily ever after fairy tale, and, you know, kind of look beyond the wedding day and at what it really means to be committed to one person for the rest of your life through thick and thin. For better or worse, you know, it can be a little bit daunting. You know, it can be a little bit, like, startling and you know, bring you up short a bit. Because, you know, most people don't think that. They kind of have this, oh, you know, the wedding will be great and it'll all kind of work out. Or it'll be just like living together. So, you know, yeah, I think it's really good for couples to see together, whether married, not married, older, younger, toddlers. Whatever.
Thanks a lot for coming on, and come back soon. And,
all right.
You know, when you're got the music doc. All right.
Marriage is not a perfect institution.
Sometimes when I think he's the biggest jerk in the world, and then he'll do something funny, and I'll laugh, and I'll think to myself, oh, that's why I married him.
This is a film about the mystery of marriage. What we enter marriage thinking it will be.
Promise to be your lifelong companion.
And what it turns out to be.
That's the show, folks. Thanks for listening in. What's coming up on FilmWax Radio in the next few weeks? We have a conversation with Steve James. You remember Steve? He directed Hoop Dreams, one of the most beloved documentaries ever made. He also has made a number of other documentaries, quite a bunch, and he works with this production house called Cartemquin Films, which is located in Chicago. which is also where Steve James is based. His latest documentary is called Life Itself, and if you haven't heard about it, you will. It's about the life of Roger Ebert, the film critic who passed away a couple of years ago. And it's full of surprises. Anyway, he made the documentary in collaboration with Roger's widow, Chaz Ebert, and it was terrific. I saw it some months ago. Interviewed Steve when he was in New York after that particular screening, and he gave me a lot of his time, and I've been sitting on this interview for months now, and I'm very excited to finally put it up next week. So that's the should be the next episode of the podcast. We have so much more stuff coming up that I'm starting to get nervous about it, but I hope you do enjoy that. Also coming up in the next few weeks, a conversation I had with actor and filmmaker Jace Bartok, who sat with me, and also included in that conversation is the actress Daphne Rubin Vega, who is in a new film that Jace has directed. Also coming up soon is we'll put up the live podcast that we just did during the Northside Film Festival last week. I have the show, and we're going to put that up in the next couple of weeks. And finally, the also delayed conversation that I'm finally putting up that I had with Joe Swanberg. He has a bunch of films up on the Fandor website, but also, just as importantly, Joe has a brand new film called Happy Christmas, which is opening up this momentarily. All that coming up and more. So thank you for listening to Filmwax Radio. Of course, as always, please do subscribe again if you haven't subscribed. It just takes just a couple of minutes to go to iTunes. And, you know, rate the show. Give it a star rating, because as more people do that, the show becomes more visible. It shows up on more search results, or it shows up when somebody likes another podcast in a similar vein. My show will come up, and maybe they'll subscribe to it. Word gets out, and then more people are listening, and more people consider sponsoring my show, and then I have a more successful life, so I can focus on the podcast and continuing to do better shows. I mean, this is it, though. You know, this is basically what I'm doing. This is what you get. But I just want to have a continuity, maybe get access to some pretty cool actors to include a little bit more frequently, things like that. You know, some industry leaders that I may not have access to quite yet. With a bigger audience, it won't be any problem. So just consider that as you talk to your friends and as you consider subscribing. So thank you so much. Adam Chartoff signing off. Filmwax Radio episode number 221. This show is presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time. Distract.
do.